You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm from the ESPN 97.5 studios. Here's Glenn Davis.
Welcome back to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5. Again, a big thank you tonight to our presenting sponsor, the Daspit Law Firm, and also to Kings Court down on 903 Hutchins. That is the home of the Houston Red Army, the Manchester United supporters group, also the home of the Chelsea Bayou City Blues. I was down there this past weekend. We had a wonderful time down there. We had Soccer Matters t-shirts and jewelry all down there at Kings Court, and we thank them for tonight bringing in some wonderful food. Also, Advantage BMW Midtown. Go in and say hello to my friends Sergio, Justin, and Philip. Advantage BMW in Midtown. They have you covered from sales right through to service. The customer service is ridiculous. It is one of the reasons why I'm in a BMW, outside of the fact that it is the ultimate driving machine. I've leased from Advantage BMW Midtown. It is the place to go. They are huge supporters of soccer, so we thank them for that. All right, Liverpool legend Steve Nicol won a European Cup with them. We know him for many, many appearances for Liverpool. We also know that he has met at some point down here in Houston with some of the Liverpool supporters groups that we love down here in Houston, Texas, our good man Roger and Matt. He also was the coach of the New England Revolution in Major League Soccer. Here is Steve Nicol talking a number of different topics, including managers and his time reminiscing at Liverpool. All right, Steve, so Chelsea goes down this weekend, and we hear Mauricio Sarri coming out talking about the fact that the players are hard to motivate. I know you've been pretty vocal about this during the week, but can you take us into that and how you see that comment to the press as a manager yourself?
I've got to say I was really surprised. You know, this is a guy whose kind of reputation was that he just gets on with things and makes things work. So for him to come out and say that, you know, he can't motivate the players, I mean, the bottom line to do it in public, in my opinion, is the last shot. You know, you have to do so many other things and training and talking to them and everything else. And then when all else fails, then I guess your last shot is you do it in public. So for him to do this so early is a real surprise. But the crux of the matter is half the job is motivating your players. And it's not just about motivating them on game day. You know, it's a process. You know, you have to constantly be talking to them, encouraging them, you know, giving them a kick up the backside when needed. You know, so this is not just a turn up on day of the game and try and motivate them. This is a whole process. And if he's saying he can't do that, then that's a huge problem.
Steve, you know, you had incredible managers at Liverpool. Tell me some of their methods and how they do it, how they did it back in your day when you were a player.
Straight to the point, straight in your face, straight at you, and tell you. You know, I was fortunate that I joined a group of players and played with a group of players for a good decade that were kind of self-motivated as individuals and as a group. You know, if somebody fell out of line or somebody wasn't toeing the line or giving it enough, whether it be in training or games or hiding or whatever it would be, we would police ourselves. But if that wasn't working, then, you know, the coaches would step in and just tell you in no uncertain terms that what you were doing wasn't good enough and you had to change it.
You were signed by Bob Paisley. Tell me a little bit about him, because you had to be patient before you ever got your first team opportunity.
Yeah, I did. I mean, Bob was only there probably 18 months when I was there, and I spent probably that 18 months, I probably played, what, two or three games when there was injuries, and I was learning the Liverpool way. So it was more after Bob, as far as, you know, Joe Fagan and then Kenny Dalglish. I mean, you talk about a guy who does not allow you to slip below what he thinks your level is. So, you know, Kenny would probably be the hardest taskmaster that I ever played for. I mean, I remember Alan Hansen had asked me to play in the testimonial for a pal of his. This was pre-season. This is probably back in 87 or 88. We travelled down to Bristol City on the Friday, which is at that time a good 6 hour drive in a bus. Played a game, a good 6 hour drive back on the Saturday. Got up on the Sunday morning, travelled to Glasgow with Alan Hansen, another 4 hours. Played a game. We actually had a couple of beers after the game. Another 4 hours back. And Phil Neal had a testimonial on the Monday. Now, Kenny had said to us, listen, I'll try not to play you. I know you've had a tough couple of days, a lot of travelling, a lot of playing, but, you know. And we were okay, because our legs had gone. I mean, sitting in a bus for... I mean, just add it up. You're talking about 25 hours in a bus or something crazy, playing two games. And then the game comes on the Monday. And I end up going on with, 20 minutes to go. Now, I couldn't feel my legs. My legs had gone, and I just got through the 20 minutes, and I came off after the game, and he walked straight up to me and said, what was that? And I was like, what do you mean? He said, what was that? I said, I don't know what you mean. He said, look, he says, if you're going to do that, just tell me, and you're not playing. That's fine. He said, but don't go out there and do that. I was gobsmacked. Wow. Now, you talk about keeping somebody on their toes. So, you know, motivation can be a lot of things. It can be a hug, but it can also be a large kick right up the backside that keeps you on your toes.
But how has that changed now? Is that even possible with some of the modern-day athletes that are multi-millionaires? There was a container back then that allowed coaches to be a little bit more straight to the point. I think that container's gone now, right?
In a word? No. There's no way that players would take that. They would crumble. I mean, to be honest, your player today, and it's all to do with the money. You know, money makes you comfortable. And when you've got too much of it, I'm assuming, because I don't know that, that it would make you even more comfortable. So I think players don't have the backbone that we had. They certainly didn't have the upbringing. You know, to become who you are as a player, you have to go through certain things. And if you're taken by the hand from, you know, you look at all the academies now, and, you know, they're signing kids when they're 9 and 10 years old. So, you know, they've been brought up by the hand. They're taken everywhere. They're told what to do. And if something goes wrong, they're not looking to take responsibility. You know, I guess that's the most important word. I don't think enough players today take responsibility for themselves. When things are not working out, they're always looking for an excuse, or it's not my fault. I mean, responsibility as a player is a huge part of what makes you.
He's Steve Nichol, former Liverpool defender. Wasn't the Champions League then? It was, he won the European Cup final twice. Liverpool player, you see him on ESPN FC. Also, don't forget, he took the New England Revolution to many MLS Cup finals here in the United States. How about a quick shout on at Major League Soccer and how things maybe have changed since you've managed in the league?
I think the opportunity to go and spend more money and sign bigger name players and bring in a better quality of foreign player is the biggest thing for me. I mean, the crowds are through the roof. You have to look at Atlanta, what's going on there, and Seattle, that's been... I mean, it seems old hat now that there's 50,000 at Seattle.
Yeah.
It's almost exactly. A given. So that whole thing has changed. But I think the fact there's more money in the game, more money obviously has its downfalls. We kind of spoke about some players having too much money. But I think for a coach now, most of the teams have a good budget. They can, if they're smart and they've got good scouting systems and have good mates around the world, can go and get better players. So I think that's one of the biggest differences I've noticed.
What about quality of play? You know, obviously individual players that are foreigners that are better players are going to improve the quality of play, I guess, singularly. Mm. But collectively, what do you see? How do you see teams playing now? And do you see them playing differently than maybe back in the years you were with the Revs?
As far as playing's concerned, there's this kind of snobbery that you have to pass it from the goalkeeper out to the back, and it has to be done that way, and if you don't do that, then you're a dinosaur, or you're stuck in the dark ages. And I think that's it's not always possible. Depends on the players you have. If you have players that can do that, then yes, that's great. But if you don't, you know, if I'm a coach playing against a side who has a back four, for example, who are not particularly great on the ball, I'm going to squeeze the life out of them. I'm not even going to make the goalie kick it. I'm just going to hang back and wait till he plays it, and then we're going to squeeze the life out of them. So as far as the quality of player, I think no question there are more foreign players that are better than... I shouldn't say better than the ones that were there, because there were some fantastic players. Yeah. You know, your Valderramas and people like that.
Maybe the amount of them?
I think it's the number, I think there's a number, which should help, you know, your average American player. I think one of the downfalls is that there's so many teams that, you know, you need a squad of 30. There's, 22 teams, is it?
Yeah.
I mean,
going up.
Do the math. That's 600 and something players. So you're kind of diluting a lot of the players that are actually in the league that maybe shouldn't be playing in a top-class league. But I'm interested to see what happens. You know, everybody... I remember sitting down with Mike Burns and some of the guys from MLS probably, well, maybe a good 10, 12 years ago, and they were talking about how important it was that everybody had an academy. I think that's fantastic. So I think the way the product is better from the average American is, let's see how many players are coming through these academies, because it should be a good thing. It should make them better. It should give them a better understanding of the game. So I'm interested to see in the next maybe five to ten years, academies producing a lot of players and a lot of better players.
Yeah, I think that's a real question. And for me, when I look around the league, Steve, I sometimes see that I think there's a bigger investment from some teams than others in truly trying to produce players that, you know, they're carrying through since they're really young ages. So I do think that's one to keep a real
I just hope we spoke about it earlier. I just hope that what doesn't happen is, because I know when I came to MLS and certainly the USL before that, players weren't looking to be led by the hand, as we talked about before. And I hope, because of the academies, it doesn't produce players that think they can be led by the hand and can, you know, all the things we talked about, when things go wrong, they don't look to say, you know, you didn't tell me this, or you didn't tell me that. You know, you have to get the right balance between looking after them, yes, and, you know, certainly a bit of mollycoddling doesn't do anybody harm, but you have to make sure you don't go too far.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Steve Nichol joining us here, European Cup winner 1983 and 84 with Liverpool. Obviously, we have a great Liverpool supporters group here in Houston. And, of course, you met some of them when you were down here, Steve. So they're certainly liking to hear this interview. You know, do you ever look back and you just say, look at the names? You know, when I look at your body of work and I hear and see the names, number one, what you achieved as a player yourself personally, the teams that you were on, the managers, the Soonises, the Dalglishes, you know, your first cap for Scotland comes from the legendary Jock Stein. You know, do you ever look back and just go, my God, you know, these situations I've been in, how do you reflect on that, if at all?
Absolute pride. Fantastic. You know, I've done some appearances, you know, down in Houston and different parts of the country and even at home. And again, it's down to how you're brought up, particularly at Liverpool. You know, I can remember sitting in the dressing room, the likes of 88. I mean, I've been there for seven, nearly 8 years. And when the team's given out, they keep you on your toes so much that you're still waiting to hear your name.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when the team's picked, you're turning to someone saying, but who's not playing? Because the only thing you're listening for is your name. You never got complacent. And so you never actually... The last thing in your mind is looking at what you're doing or what you've done. It's making sure you, as I said, Kenny Dalglish held us to a standard. So that's what you're concentrating on when you're playing. You're making sure that you keep your standard of what you're capable of. And then now when you become an old geezer, it's nice to look back and then you go, hey, that wasn't bad. I thought it was number one, great fun, but one experience, and to be in all those situations that I was, some great, some horrendous, but generally just fantastic.
Do you go back to Liverpool ever, Steve?
Very rarely. I was there a couple of years ago. I brought out a book, 5 league titles and a packet of crisps. So I did some signings there, went back to Anfield, and as I said, when you go back, you kind of realise that, you know, you're still remembered all these years later, and you think, you know, I must have done something right.
When you walk, you know, into Anfield, coming back there, what sort of emotion did you feel?
Do you know, the greatest thing was they actually, all the old geezers, they got them on the field. They were opening the new stand, and there was probably 35 of us on the field introduced before the game. And it's amazing, walking on the field, you remember every blade of grass, you remember every situation, you remember your points of reference, you remember things that happened on that particular spot at any given time you were standing on it. Yeah. So it's absolutely incredible.
Wow.
Something I'd never thought about, but it wasn't until I put a foot on the field, and then you just go back and you think, man, wow, I remember standing out here while you're waiting on the ball or going at somebody. Or, yeah. You know, it was an incredible experience.
Unbelievable. What a career. You're continuing it here in America, talking football and helping grow the game in that way. We thank you, as always, for coming on, Steve. It's always a real honor to have you on the show.
No problem. Thanks, Glenn.
All right. That's Steve Nichol. Incredible player for Liverpool, obviously now with ESPN FC. Played for Scotland as well. Got his first cap under Jock Stein. And, man, when we get him on, there's just some incredible moments you can hear. We could have went on for a day. Take a break. More to come. All right, so that was Steve Nichol. We could have went on forever. Some amazing testimony there from his time. He sent me a text after that interview and said, thank you for taking me back down memory lane. And a real thanks to Steve Nichol. I've called a few games with him in the past. And again, you can catch him up at ESPN FC. What I love about him, no nonsense, truly respects the game in so many different ways. Hey, Liberty Kitchen, you got a number of great locations. My favorite Liberty Kitchen location, my good friends Carl Eves and Lance Fegan, is the one over in the Heights. Get over to Liberty Kitchen in the Heights or check the one out on Post Oak or the Treehouse in Memorial. Liberty Kitchen, providing incredible food. Get over there. Salmon, seafood, steaks, chops, you name it. Liberty Kitchen has it. Thank you, Liberty Kitchen, for being sponsors of Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5.
My name is Stephen A. Smith, and you're listening to 98.7.
Wait, what?
I said 98.7, that's my show.
Let's try this one more time, okay?
My name is Stephen A. Smith, and you're listening to 97.5 FM.
You are listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the ESPN 97.5 studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, we roll on here tonight on Soccer Matters ESPN 97.5, and thanks to everybody tuning in tonight here. Hey, also thanks to King's Court for bringing in what is some amazing Indian food here tonight. And a number of people throughout the studio have been dining on this wonderful cuisine. King's Court, 903 Hutchins, right down by the stadium. You can go in there Saturday before the Dynamo will take on RGV in that sort of an open friendly match down there where fans are encouraged to come. Yeah, you have to sign up an RSVP, but something tells me if you go down there, the Dynamo will find a way to get you into the stadium. Great opportunity now to catch up with Tom Beyer. Now, Tom Beyer is in player development. He is an author of a book and creator of a program called Soccer Starts at Home. He is a huge hit in Asia. He has had a television show over there. He has implemented these programs in Japan and China. And he will be here in Houston on the 29th at BBVA Compass Stadium to give a presentation. Information on that at HoustonDynamo.com. Tom, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Hi, Glenn. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, so take into my listeners here a little bit about what soccer starts at home is.
Sure. It stems from, you know, I've been a technical coach for over 25 years. And for most people who might not know what a technical coach is, basically, I've been in the business of helping players to improve technically. Soccer being an extremely technical sport, and unfortunately takes a ridiculous amount of practice to actually become pretty good at it. So based on all of my technical work that I've done over the years, I really had a major breakthrough about development when my first son was born, and he first started walking. And it's an interesting story, but it's an important one. I was doing an event for Adidas Sportsmaker, who I've been under. I was their soccer ambassador in Japan. And after the event, I was signing these miniature little footballs or soccer balls that were replica after the 2006 German World Cup. And while I had the ball in my hand, literally, it's like the proverbial apple, but ball fell right in my hand. I started thinking that, you know, small ball, and my first son had just started walking. So I thought, small ball, small foot, small child. So I asked the guys to send me a couple of these balls to my house. So a big box arrives at my house, and I've got about 20 of these little miniature balls. So I went and I took two or three balls and put them in every room of my house. And from day one, when my boy would address the ball and stand up to play with it, I would discourage him from kicking it. And I would encourage him to do more what we call kind of ball manipulation, ball mastery, and basically taught him from a very young age how to just pull the ball back. Pull the ball back, stop, start, turn. And all of this happened inside the living room or inside the house. And, you know, I hadn't realized, because I'd always been working with other people's kids, because I didn't have any of my own at the time, is that I hadn't realized how much time a small child spends in the house, a ridiculous amount of time. So I made these balls part of the environment. I made the ball basically the favorite toy. And then I really started to put development under a microscope and kind of pondered this idea of, like, or this thought of why out of 211 FIFA member association countries, only 8 have ever won a World Cup. And out of those 8, there's really only kind of a handful of what I call serial repeaters. So I started studying these countries that were producing the best players and that were getting the best results. And I figured out, basically, or I couldn't figure out, that there was any kind of special kind of secret sauce in coaching. And what I came upon was is that basically these countries had cultures that were in place that were extremely conducive to developing players, because players were becoming exposed to a ball and engaging with a ball from a very, very young age. So I became obsessed about studying about development and reading national curriculums and countries. And I realized that the soccer world has basically not understood the role that the parents play in helping and development. So that's kind of the start of how it came about. And then I've basically spent the last few years traveling around the world, being invited in, because I've created a presentation. I wrote a book called Soccer Starts at Home. But the presentation is loaded with tons of videos, which I document not just one son, but two sons, their development from the time they could walk until fast forward now. My boys are 10 and 13. So it's quite compelling when you see the presentation.
Pretty incredible. He's Tom Beyer, Soccer Starts at Home. He's an author and creator of this. So the first thing I think about when you're describing this, and this is fascinating, those cultures that are so ingrained in soccer and those fathers, you know, they understand the value of the ball. There is a huge value placed on the ball at the feet of someone. In our country, a lot of times it's just kick it. Right? I mean, let's face it, it gets down to that. I think that's obviously changing with changing demographic as well. But that's an ideology. How do you change that mentality? And I guess you're doing it by going around and slowly trying to pick people off in talking and developing, talking and giving presentations about your program, like the one that'll be on the 29th at BBVA Compass Stadium.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is that if you go around, the entry level for the sport, Glenn, is usually kicking or shooting. And what do I mean by that? If you go around to most parks around the world, you'll find them filled often with little kids, father or mother. And what they're doing is they're just kicking the ball back and forth, because many families just think that that's the way that you know, that's the game. It's basically, soccer's a passing game. So, yeah, why wouldn't kicking be the first technique that you teach? But I go around and I basically discourage that from the early ages. Mm-hmm. And instead I teach parents to teach their kids more on how to protect the ball. Now, if you were to give a ball to, let's say, an American kid that never played before, and you give them a ball and you challenge them for that ball, they'll do one of maybe three things. They'll either kick the ball and chase after it, they might bend over and pick it up, or they might freeze. Now, you give that same ball to the little Spanish boy or the little Brazilian or the you know, some of the countries that really have such a soccer culture of play.
Correct.
And you give them a ball and challenge them, and they'll usually try to beat you. Or they'll pull the ball back and they'll protect it. So I found that from a very young age, teaching my boys to protect rather than to constantly give it away is key. Now, the other thing that I really realized from studying a lot of countries, too, is that kids don't necessarily fall in love with the game of soccer at first. They fall in love with the ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the trigger is. They fall in love with the ball, and then afterwards, that's where they fall in love with the game. But when you go around to Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, you know, a lot of these countries that, you know, where they produce so many great players, you'll find there's just a completely different mindset.
It's the fascination. He's Tom Beyer. Soccer starts at home, the 29th at BBVA Compass Stadium. You're not going to want to miss this presentation. I can just see you doing this probably 7 days of the week, quite frankly, Tom. I want to ask you about your time in Japan. Was sure. Culturally that the place to start this? In other words, culturally, would it have been easier to begin soccer starts at home in Japan as opposed to the United States?
That's a good question, and it's a little bit of a misunderstanding. A lot of the work that I did in Japan was purely as a technical coach.
Okay.
So basically, soccer starts at home is something relatively new, because, again, I didn't really start. I went to Japan in the late 1980s. I played there. I finished from playing, and I basically spent 20-plus years just purely as a technical coach. All of the work, all the events, I wrote books, I've created, you know, VHS videos, but, you know, DVDs, I did TV shows. That was all to highlight the technical component. So we basically, and to kind of borrow a phrase from my good friend Anson Dorrance from UNC,
mm-hmm.
Anson says, you know, we infected an entire generation into the belief that if you really want to be a good soccer player, it starts with the technical component. China has probably benefited a little bit more from my soccer starts at home than Japan does, because for the last couple of years, I've spent a lot of time in China working with the Chinese government. The Ministry of Education oversees soccer development, and they have what's called the 50,000 school program, where they've designated 50,000 schools are soccer schools. So I've got a very, very big media presence in China, and I did a daily show there together with David Beckham, which broadcasted 365 days a year. So I've had a pretty big impact on China, at least when it comes to the soccer starts at home. But, you know, I think the U.S. is by far the market that I think that this could work the best, because, I mean, parents just take such an interest in their kids, and this is where we need it, because we need to hit the reset button in this country.
But you've got to change hearts and minds, don't you? I mean, you really got to change hearts and minds.
You do, but I think starting with the youngest kids is much easier. You know, I always say it's easier to work in a country with no soccer culture than it is to work in a country with the wrong soccer culture. So I think that when you dial it down and you're talking about dealing with parents, young parents of kids that are 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age, it's a bit different, because I've seen the reaction too. I've seen the reaction, and people will see it in my presentation. I've got videos not just of my kids, but I've got videos of kids from the United States here whose fathers and mothers have read our book and then put an action plan in place. And you can see the transformation even in 2 or 3 years since the book came out. And people send me videos constantly of their kids. So it's quite compelling when you actually see it.
Super exciting. Tom Beyer, you're not going to want to miss this. The 29th at BBVA Compass Stadium. 6:30 is the time. You go to HoustonDynamo.com for this presentation. Get out there and see Tom. I think if you're anyone that has young children and involved in player development, this is something you are not going to want to miss. Now, you and I got to figure out when you get here Sunday, because I'd love to meet with you, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. Because to be honest with you, too, who do we focus on? We focus on everybody, and especially people in the media, because the media can play a massive role in a positive way of getting this word out. So that's why my schedule, I'll be in Houston for several days. It's packed with media interviews, because this is the best way that we can speak to the masses. And, you know, it really does resonate with people. You know, I've done a lot of work. I've done a lot of media work. And Australia, I filmed a special before the World Cup in Australia for a broadcaster. And I basically linked 11 players to Soccer Starts at Home. And what do I mean by that is that all 11 players that I selected, not Australian players, but worldwide, I'll tell you in a second, but all of those 11 players all had the same component. All of them started between the ages of 2 and 5, very early, and all of them attribute their success to their fathers and sometimes their mothers. Who are those players? Messi, Ronaldo, Neymar, Suarez, Modric, Pogba, Iniesta, Lewandowski, Cruz. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt. When you study the great players, you'll find that all of them started before they cross over the line. So basically, the whole idea and the concept, the elevator pitch, here it is. Okay, if you can get your child, he or she, comfortable with the ball at their feet and can do the basics, stop, start, turn, change direction, and protect the ball before they cross over that line in organized play, which is age 6, usually first grade, that's the game changer. And a gap basically occurs between the other players that is very, very difficult to close that gap. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do by engaging parents.
So exciting, Tom. We're excited you're coming to Houston. Wonderful. And I know you and Paul Holliker have connected, the Dynamo Academy head. Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight, and we will see you in Houston.
Thank you, Glenn.
All right, that's Tom Beyer, author, creator, Soccer Starts at Home. He's going to be in Houston 29th at BBVA Compass Stadium for a presentation. Wow, that was a fascinating interview. You're not going to want to miss it. HoustonDynamo.com. All right, my friends at Advantage BMW in Midtown. Now, I've driven one for a number of years. I've leased. I bought from Advantage. You go down there. One of the things you'll always notice about Advantage BMW is the customer service. It's second to none. AdvantageBMWHouston.com. They are in Midtown. If you're going to get into one of these machines, this is the place to do it. Go down there, say hello to Sergio. Go down there, say hello to Justin. And go down there to say hello to Philip Southwick. Those guys love soccer. Let's put our cash and our money towards people that are supporting the game of soccer here in Houston. All right, we'll take a break. More to come.
ESPN 97.5. You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN975.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm from the ESPN 97.5 studios. Here's Glenn Davis.
Tonight, we're going to end it in big fashion here, and we're going to talk some Liga MX and some of the big stories going on in Mexico. And, of course, we once again thank our presenting sponsor, the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. We go down to Guadalajara, Mexico, and he is the one and only Tom Marshall of ESPN FC. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, Glenn, yeah. Just getting into the season now with 3 rounds of games gone. So, you know, we're seeing a few things after, and we're getting a feel of, you know, where the teams are at, basically.
So let's start with one that's close to home here in the state of Texas, because the former FC Dallas coach, Oscar Perea, now at Tijuana, finally gets his first win against, I believe it was León, on the road. Talk a little bit about Tijuana now and how much pressure is on Oscar Perea to perform there, and how much of a leash does he have?
I mean, historically, the managers, the head coaches at Tijuana have not been given a lot of time. I think really the win away at León over the weekend was really just a bit of breathing space because, you know, in the first two games, Tijuana didn't score. They lost both the games. It didn't look particularly good. But against Leon, they showed basically they were fighting. I mean, they didn't particularly play well. But, you know, they've got Gustavo Bolt back, the striker, and I think he's been a big signing. So he's got a massive job there because, you know, we've seen recently Carlos Salcedo just signed for Tigres from Eintracht Frankfurt. We've seen Maximiliano Mesa signed for Monterrey from Independiente. So we've seen some really big signings from the big clubs, and we've not seen the same from Tijuana. So it's not like, you know, Oscar Pareja has got a team that are investing a lot of money in the squad. It's kind of like, you know, mid-table, probably mid to lower table. So, you know, it's really tough because obviously, you know, he doesn't have experience in the league. And it's a squad that, you know, it's not coming from a particularly amazing season either. So, you know, there is a lot of pressure on him, and it's not like up there, you know, with Dallas where you've got a bit of time to kind of sort things out. It's like they want results and they want to be in or near the playoff mix for sure at the end of the season.
He's Tom Marshall of ESPN FC. Tom, I got to think, for Oscar Pareja now to go from a market like Dallas where there really isn't any healthy pressure, let's be honest, if we're really being upfront here, and then you go to a market like Tijuana, how much pressure does he get put upon him with the press? And obviously that's at a different level than it was in Major League Soccer.
Yeah, I think there is more. I mean, what I would say is that it's not the same in Tijuana as, say, you know, one of the big Mexico City teams, or even, you know, a team like Chivas, or even the Monterrey teams. But yeah, obviously, you know, Tijuana is a one team town, and I think from his point of view, though, that's what he probably liked. That's what he probably attracted to him, the job. I mean, obviously he had things nicely set up at Dallas. I think he earned a lot of respect for what he did, especially with the young players. But I think now he knows that if he can make an impact with Tijuana, then it could lead to a bigger job within Mexico, or you know, move beyond Mexico to South America or even to Europe. So yeah. I mean, I think he kind of wants to prove himself under that little bit more pressure.
Yeah, no question about it, and I think everybody here with Major League Soccer and those who know Oscar are hoping that he's going to do well. All right, let's flip to Tata Martino now as we stay on managers here. Now, his appointment to Mexico, I think we were all just taken aback by how good this guy was here, how adaptable he was, how flexible. Can he take Mexican football in a different direction under the container that is currently the Mexican national team and all the politics that are involved?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he can take it in a different direction, to be honest. I think, you know, the direction's pretty much set, and I don't think the head coach has the influence to kind of move within, you know, outside of those tracks the way it's heading. But what I do think is that San Martino, you know, like you said there, Glenn, he has got that ability to make a good team better, get that extra 5%, the extra 10%, or whatever it may be. Mm. I think Tata Martino 100% has that, you know, in his bag. I think he's proven it before. And I think for Mexico, it's a massive, massive signing. You know, one of the best hirings, I think, that the Federation has made in, you know, certainly in recent years.
How does he do that? Does he do that tactically? Does he do that motivationally? I mean, what areas do you see that he can improve the Mexican player, both from a motivational standpoint and from a tactical standpoint?
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, I think obviously both. But I was actually recently, I went down to Rosario, to his hometown, you know, and I'm speaking to people in Newell's Old Boys, his former club. And, you know, let's not forget, he took Newell's Old Boys in 2011, fighting relegation. And in 2013, you know, they won the Argentine League and they did very well in the Copa Libertadores. And you ask people there and they say, Union, this is a guy who comes in and he gets the players united, he gets them going in the same direction. And, you know, we've seen with Mexico that's been really difficult to do. Where, you know, we know there's been kind of, you know, there's a kind of not the best atmosphere in the dressing room between the top players and the federation. There's kind of beefs about, you know, payments still from the World Cup, the bonus payments. So, yeah, from that side, I think Martino's very, very good at the man management. And then, obviously, from the tactical point of view, he plays the right way. I think that's really important. I think that's important to Mexico as well because, you know, Mexican players, very technical. They like to have the ball. And I think whoever would have come in needs to kind of push that even more. But he's also got the, he's kind of got a bit of pragmatism to him. You know, he'll work hard on the set pieces. You know, and he knows, like we saw in the, you know, against the Red Bulls in the MLS playoffs, when Atlanta took that lead into the second leg, they knew how to sit back. And if I'm not mistaken, they had around 35% of possession. So he does have that in his bag as well. And I think there's a certain feeling.
He made it ugly on purpose, and it worked out.
Yeah, and I think that's the balance. I mean, his DNA is to attack, but he also in his locker he also has. You know, he has variations. So, and also he's been at big, you know, let's not forget he's been at massive, massive clubs, massive federations, the national team. So, you know, in theory, he knows how to deal with the pressure. My only concern, my big concern is that, you know, he talked well with Atlanta about, you know, his next job that he wanted, you know, it'd be before his family. You know, obviously with the national team, you get a bit more time, you know, outside of training and stuff, but, you know, I don't know. I just feel like the recent Mexico managers haven't, their families can't have had the best time. I mean, you look at Osorio, he went through a lot. Miguel Herrera, obviously, he swung a punch at a journalist because of something he said about his daughter. I mean, yeah. Sepo de la Torre suffered, you know. So I just hope he's kind of factored all that kind of stuff into his decision making.
Yeah, no question. I think that's going to be very interesting to watch. It's going to be interesting to watch how the Mexican media handles him as well. And I guess, for me, this is an incredible hire because I think all the things that you said are going to occur with this guy. And the reason I say that even more is based on watching Atlanta United, what he's done in his past, where he's been. But also, we've had Dario Sala, who was the assistant coach at Atlanta, and he just went on and on about what a guy when it comes to bringing people together and fighting for a singular ideal that Tata Martino is. And there was a lot of that. And we do know the talent of the Mexican player. So that combined with a one-for-all singular attitude that's led by an inspirational manager could be absolutely incredible. But, you know, Mexico's always got this really weird conundrum where, you know, they get excited about Argentine players, Argentine coaches, yet then they want to rip them apart. So that media side, I'm interested to see how that's going to happen. Do you think the knives are going to be out on Tata Martino from the word go when the first thing goes wrong?
Yeah.
And they'll be sharp.
Yeah. I mean, when things go wrong, no doubt about it. What I would say is, though, because of Martino's past, because he's been at Barcelona, because he's been at Argentina, because of what he did with Paraguay, he's got a longer leash than Osorio.
Yeah.
Because Osorio, right from the beginning, it was like, you don't deserve this job. That was the media's kind of, that was their line. It was like, what have you done before? You've done absolutely nothing. We don't respect what you've done before, and you don't deserve this job. Whereas Tata Martino, he coming into it, he does have that a bit of a longer leash. But if Mexico, you know, go out at the semi-final to Panama or, you know, to make it at the Gold Cup, then the knives will be out. Absolutely no doubt about it.
Is he being treated respectfully right now by the Mexican media, I would imagine?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the way he deals with the media has helped. You know, I feel like Osorio was honest at times. You know, he'd come out and say, I want more players in Europe. And it was kind of, I felt like people within the Mexican game, especially within the Liga MX, hated that. Because it was almost disrespecting the league, even though it was true, and even though Martino probably thinks the same, I don't think he's going to say things like, I think he's going to learn from what Osorio went wrong. For example, Carlos Salcedo. I mean, you've got a kid 25 years old starting centre back in the Bundesliga, who moves back to Tigres. I mean, that can't be good for the national team in terms of having your players playing at that.
Why did that happen?
Level.
In your estimation, why did he come back to Mexico?
I mean, obviously, money is a factor. Tigres pay big money. It's almost like money doesn't even matter to them. You know, it's unbelievable, really, how much they spend. And secondly, I think the family is there. He's had an ongoing problems with his immediate family, his father, his mother, his sister. And I think that's taken its toll, to be honest. He had to travel back from Mexico, from Germany a couple of times for a paternity claim that was going on in Guadalajara. So I think he decided to come back to Mexico. He's obviously, you know, he's married, he's got a kid, and he thought, you know, I want to be closer to, you know, to what I know and stuff. And, mm-hmm. so, and he said that he wants to raise his kid within Mexico. So, I mean, it's a family reason that you can't, you know, blame the guy. But from a wider angle, it's not ideal for the Mexican national team to have these players be coming back from top leagues.
Martin Palermo, just named the manager at Pachuca. We all know how famous he was as a soccer player for Argentina and Boca Juniors, and also for missing three penalty kicks in a game in 1999 in the Copa America against Colombia. what's he going to bring to Pachuca?
We don't really know. we're not too sure. And I say that because, and this is the talking point here, this hiring has not gone down well at all. Everybody knows Palermo as a player, but nobody really knows what he's like as a manager. You know, he's been at Arsenal, he's been at Godoy Cruz in Argentina, he's been at Unión Española in the Chilean league, but he doesn't seem like his trajectory is on the rise. He's not a manager that you pluck from Argentina and you think, oh, this is a really, really good young manager, he's going places. Yeah. It feels like this is a big name. He probably talks a good game. Now let's see what he can do. And so, you know, obviously he needs to be given time. And I think Pachuca are basically looking for something similar to what Matias Almeida did with Chivas, to come there, to be charismatic, to be this, you know, big former player, to bond the group together and get them working and get in the playoffs. Because Pachuca, as much as we talk about them producing players, Eric Gutierrez, Irving Lozano, Hector Herrera, they've not made the playoffs now in over 2 years, so that's the goal right now. Forget the youth for a second. This is a club now that has to make the playoffs, that's invested big money. Edwin Cardona's there, Ismael Sosa's back. We'll have to see. But you know, the other thing, Glenn, just in the side, is that there's a lot of Mexican coaches out there, head coaches, who are looking at this hiring and thinking, what do we have to do, or what do we have to do to get help within Mexico? Because if you're getting a guy from Argentina who hasn't necessarily got a great record, then how are we going to be given the chance? So it's that's the debate going on right now with regards to Palermo's hiring over there at Pachuca.
Boy, that's a common practice in a lot of countries. You know, people are worrying now about the lack of, you know, the more jobs going to foreign managers in Major League Soccer. In England, there's a claim of prejudice that English managers aren't getting enough opportunity. So it's very interesting how that works in particular countries. Tom, as always, what a wonderful job you do. We thank you very much for coming on and really bringing some great insight to these topics.
No, thanks a lot, Glenn, for the invite. Anytime, just, you know my number, give us a call.
You are the man, Tom Marshall, and we appreciate it. Get Tom's writings at ESPNFC.com. There was no guy on top of Liga MX like Tom Marshall. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks, Glenn.
All right, so that's Tom Marshall. That ends the night, and we do it in a big fashion with Tom. A reminder here, a big thank you to King's Court tonight for bringing in all the great food that we've been munching on, the Indian food. So thanks to Jay and Megan who run the King's Court. King's Court is the place to be. I'll see you down there prior to the Dynamo open match on Saturday when they play RGV. Michael Hernandez, Victor Ariza, we thank them for all their great work on this program. And again, we remind you, podcastarena.com. Get over to Facebook Soccer Matters. Pick up a few of these T-shirts. The Soccer Matters T-shirts are T-shirts with a purpose and a meaning, and you will be helping us promote also soccer on the radio. But there is a 20% donation to pediatric cancer. And if my math is correct, I think at the end of the year, we're going to make a heck of a nice donation just based on T-shirt and jewelry sales. So get it done. On top of that, we'll just remind you that soccer matters. Good night.
ESPN 97.5.